Kansas City has been inching its way into the national food spotlight in recent years, and the latest news of Kansas City food talent getting national recognition is Sava Champagne Bar's Caitlin Corcoran, a no-nonsense lady who makes a mean drink and runs a tight ship. She's been awarded a fellowship from the James Beard Foundation to attend their Women's Entrepreneurial Leadership Program. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Caitlin Corcoran, congratulations. That's awesome news.
Thank you so much.
We are talking to you from New York, which is unusual since you're a local person, but you're there representing KCMO in some kind of press party?
Yeah, so the Kansas City Area Development Council and Visit KC host a party in New York every year called KC in NYC, and they invite press outlets to come and kind of experience Kansas City for a night. Without having to leave the Big Apple. So Chef Howard Hanna, who's my partner at Sava and the chef owner of the Rieger, and I are representing the Rieger and Sava, and then Chef Michael Corvino and Christina Corvino are representing Corvino, and then Shanita Bryant is also cooking at the event. Then there's music, there's a maker village with Made in KC.
Why do New York people want to go to this? Like, why are they... Are they talking about Kansas City so much that they need to experience us, like, as close as possible?
I don't know if it's that they're talking about us so much, but it's that we would like them to talk about us more, especially in the press. And it's easier to host something since so many news organizations and outlets are based in New York. It's easier to host a big party here than to invite everyone to fly into Kansas City for a night.
What are you hearing from people so far?
Well, the first place we went yesterday, the server immediately knew that we were in town for this, which was kind of funny because we didn't realize it was that big of a deal. She was like, she's actually getting ready to move to Kansas City. So she was really excited to talk about Kansas City to Kansas Cityans, which is awesome.
That I feel like that always happens when you travel. If you're from Kansas City, you end up talking to that one person.
Who has the connection.
Yeah.
Yes. Really that small of a world.
Well, so tell me about this fellowship. What's it about?
So it is for women who own restaurants. This year, you didn't have to necessarily be the chef owner. And last year, you did to get the fellowship, but you just have to own a restaurant and identify as a female. And then you have to have a successful business and want to learn how to grow it or expand or just, you know, better yourself and your business. So I'm really excited about that aspect. We get these tools to learn about business and finance, kind of like building blocks from Babson College. James Beard Foundation and Babson College partnered together to write the curriculum for the fellowship. In addition to the business and finance classes, there's also a lens of like gender equality and giving women, especially like the tools to know how to expand their business, but also how to mentor other women or people of color who maybe don't have access to that information as well later on.
You know, it's interesting to me that you used to have to be a chef owner, but now any degree of like ownership, any kind of ownership relationship qualifies you. From where I sit, that seems interesting in terms of possibly the gender equality piece of it, because the chef world does still strike me as being pretty male dominated.
Oh, for sure. And I definitely feel that a lot of women within the restaurant industry gravitate towards the front of house, or like you're the wine director, something that's not kitchen related. So I think that it's really great that they kind of opened up the lens a little bit more because, yeah, there's only so many women chef owners. Like, which we're already a small minority in the restaurant industry, but there's definitely, I think, more women in the front of house.
And then, I mean, this other thing I'm curious about, like, from where I sit, things also seem very chef-oriented in terms of the public's interest and enthusiasm for the food scene right now. Do you find it challenging to make a name for yourself as someone focusing more on the management and hospitality side of things?
I definitely think it's like not the glamorous side of things. It's like analyzing over spreadsheets and watching margins, which isn't like as sexy as like, I don't know, knife skills and like fire. But I do think that, like, for the front of house side, I do think that sommeliers or, like, wine directors are kind of having a moment right now because of all the documentaries out on Netflix about the court of sommeliers, and people, like, are starting to be interested about that. So I think the public is kind of interested in front of house. They just don't really, like, understand that there are a lot of, like, office-y duties that go with the restaurant. It's not all glamorous.
I want to talk to you about your history a little bit, just get to know you somewhat. I mean, you got started in food and drink and hospitality as a barista, right?
Correct. I worked at Latte Land, the Plaza locations before they expanded and merged with Caldi's, from the age of 15. And I worked for them on and off for about 6 years.
Did you, I mean, when you first started doing that, did you think this might be a serious passion and career path for you? Or was it, I hate to say just a job, but, you know, like those jobs that we take as teenagers, we don't necessarily attach that kind of thought to.
True. I definitely feel that I have always kind of known that I wanted to own at least a restaurant, if not multiple restaurants. My mom was a pastry chef when I was growing up, so I was around kitchens a lot, and I really, like, loved the energy. Now, of course, like any good parents who don't want your children to have a hard life, they definitely try to talk me out of it. So I didn't necessarily know that, like, for sure I was going to do that, but the coffee shop job was, like, the first step into getting into that world. And it's easier to get a job, I think, especially when you're under 21 in coffee than it is to be, like, in a restaurant or to have some of those same sort of skills taught to you.
What did you learn through that first barista job?
I learned how to be really nice to people who have not had their coffee yet. That's, like, it's something that's really funny, but I still think that I would rather deal with drunks than uncaffeinated people at 7 in the morning. People can be kind of mean without their coffee. I also just learned, like, the basics of, like, how to build a drink, how to, like, take care, like, pride in creating and crafting a beverage or something for someone and seeing the satisfaction when they enjoyed what you made. I think that was really a cool thing to learn.
So tell me about moving into cocktails.
So I tried for many years to break into the bartending scene. I've always been a night owl, so the coffee world was, like, kind of hard for me because the hours are so early. Like, you start your shifts at 5 in the morning sometimes. So I always kind of knew I wanted to transform into bartending. I also knew towards the end of my coffee career, because I was in coffee for a decade, that I didn't really want to open a coffee shop per se. The margins are already slimmer than a restaurant, and it wasn't my, like, passion. I knew I wanted to do, like, a little bit more with food especially. And so I, like, applied for jobs and, like, you know, said I didn't have experience, and it just took a long time for me to, like, really break through. But finally, actually when Port Fonda opened, like, 2 weeks after they opened, I, like, begged the bar manager at the time to, like, hire me. I was like, I can do anything. I was like, I'll juice limes. I'll make your syrups. I'll, like, do whatever you need me to do. And so I basically became, like, the prep bar person for a while. And then finally, one day, someone didn't show up for a shift, and I had already been studying all the cocktail recipes. So I was like, oh, I can cover it. Like, I know how to do all this.
I just want to say it takes so much passion to do what you're describing, to say, like, please, I'll do anything. I just want to be here. I just want my foot in the door. Can you talk to me about the passion that fueled you during that period of your career?
Well, a big part of my passion still, I think, is that I always want to keep learning. I always want to learn something new. And not that, like, I know everything there is to know about coffee, especially because trends change. But I was kind of over it and needed to, like, new challenge. And so that's really what I saw with cocktails and bartending, was just, like, this new challenge, this new, like, area that I had no idea about and I wanted to become very proficient in. And so, yeah, even before I got hired there, I started reading books and sitting at bartenders' bars and, like, asking them questions about classic cocktails, which was really cool.
Last time we talked, you had made an award-winning cocktail in the Paris of the Plains Cocktail Festival using mezcal, and you seemed really into mezcal at that time. Can you talk to me about just the ingredients that someone who works in the beverage area, like how you can get into a kind of drink?
Well, I think for me, because I'm still very into Mezcal, especially after going to Oaxaca last summer, I think that for me, I really have always connected with beverages in particular that come and represent the place where they grow and they're made. So coffee, for instance, I love Ethiopians. I love natural, processed, fruity, forward coffee that really represents where it's grown. And so when I moved into cocktails, I really fell in love with agave because mezcal and tequila really represent the land that they're grown in and the people whose culture creates it. All of those villages are really important to that process. And in the same way, wine. Like, wine is the ultimate sense of place. It's the terroir, champagne especially. So it's I've always just really found it, I don't know, more, I can connect to it if I can, like, put a face to who's making it and, like, a culture to, like, behind why this product is celebrated in the area that it grows and where it's from.
What do you enjoy about champagne now at Savant, like the particular setting of a champagne bar?
Well, I think for Savant and for myself particularly, I think that champagne bar sometimes is a misnomer because people think a champagne bar and they think of, like, a rap video or, like, like Disneyland. And I think that the really unique thing about Savant in the grand scheme of, like, champagne bars across the world is that we're really just a neighborhood bar that focuses on sparkling wine. We don't like, you don't need a special occasion to come in. It can be Tuesday. It can be like a heat wave break or, you know, the first warm day after a really cold April. And you just want to celebrate with a glass of wine or you just want to catch up with a friend. So I think that's what I really like about our specific kind of vibe on the champagne bar. But champagne, you know, has seen so much. So there's, like, so many battles have been fought over that land. And it's been such an integral part of European history. And I think that's really interesting in the grand scheme of why champagne is something that we use to celebrate. It's because so many battles were fought there. And people, that's what people, like, won when they won that battle, is they raided the cellars of the people who were growing the grapes and making the wine there. So I think that's a really interesting fact in it. But I also think the soil there, it's like a perfect microcosm to grow these really high acid grapes that end up being really great for sparkling wine.
So the neighborhood bar that happens to focus on sparkling wine seems like it might be part of the entrepreneurial piece of what it is you do. And
for sure.
That brings me back to this fellowship. I mean, what are some of the things that you are hoping to do as a leader in the food industry that you think this might help you do?
Well, I think that one of the first and foremost is I really want to figure out how to be, like, a better employer. I want to be able to offer benefits and health insurance and 401k and things that aren't glamorous, but restaurants don't really offer those to employees. I want people to be able to work in the restaurant industry and have a career path and not just feel like it is, you know, a part-time job or a stepping stone into another industry or while you figure out what you're doing with your freelance career work there. I do think that I would like to figure out a way for my employees to grow with me and within the company, but also that we could, like, give back to them. And so that's something that was really a motivating factor for me, is figuring out these other women who have expanded, like, how did you do that? And how did you do it sustainably? And especially in the era of the Me Too movement, like, how do you hire an HR person? Like, what does that entail? Like, how can we figure that stuff out?
Have your own experiences, maybe earlier on in the food industry, or just being friends with so many people who are at different stages of their careers in the food industry, has that informed some of these goals?
I mean, definitely. And I think, I mean, also too, though, it's like in Kansas City right now, it is really hard to hire good restaurant help. And I think a part of that is because it's not taken as seriously as a career path for people, especially in front of house. Like, people just don't treat servers with that same sort of respect. So I definitely think that has shaped my view on it. And I'd like people to understand that, like, yeah, you can work in the restaurant industry and serve or bartend, and, like, you can do that for 20 years, you know? Obviously, most people would like to grow and change and have better hours and stuff like that, but that's part of, like, figuring out how I would grow and how I would expand and doing it sustainably, but also figuring out what positions I don't even realize I'm going to need to fill.
The Feast magazine article announcing that you got this fellowship says that you've been quietly making a name for yourself. And can you talk about that quietly piece? Because I would say from what I've observed that you don't have a like bombastic swagger or anything. But I would also say you don't appear to be a delicate flower.
Right. I don't really understand how to interpret that either, because I feel like I've also just been like doing what I do. And recently, like, Insta-storying everything because I'm obsessed with Instagram. But so I don't know. I feel like I also feel like that Kansas City is so small, so it's easier to get a name for yourself, I guess. I don't know. I don't really understand the quietly aspect either, I suppose.
Well, our next guest is Amy Thielen. She's a chef and cookbook author, and she hosts a Food Network TV show all about Midwestern food. And she's worked at, like, top New York restaurants, but she does her thing now from a very down-to-earth Midwestern setting, like a remote cabin in the woods. Does what she's doing as a woman, as a Midwesterner, and a food industry leader, does that mean something to you?
Oh, definitely. And I think it's really great that she's like carved her own path to get there, because I think that's what you have to do in the food industry if you maybe don't want to have a traditional GM position, but you still want to be involved with food, or you don't want to necessarily be the chef every night working the line, but you still have this connection to talking about the sense of place and where you come from, and you want your cuisine to be taken seriously and recognized. So I think it's really awesome what she's doing. I've read her books, and I'm really excited to hear her on the next segment of this show.
Well, Caitlin Corcoran, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gina. Have a good day.
You too. Caitlin is a managing partner at Sava. She just won a James Beard Fellowship for Women in Entrepreneurial Leadership, and she joined us from New York, where she's repping KC. Up next, the new Midwestern Table's Amy Thielen on choosing the road less traveled, giving up a place in New York's kitchens to make an honest food back home in the woods of Minnesota. The Food Network's Amy Thielen has worked in some of the world's most prestigious kitchens in New York City, but her show, Heartland Table, is set in her rustic Minnesota cabin, which is not just rustic as in made to look rustic either. Her husband built this place by hand before they met, and back when she first moved in, there was no running water or electricity. It was in this cabin, by the light of a kerosene lamp, that she got serious about food. Amy's approach to cuisine is very Midwestern, very unpretentious, and it's often meant to please a picky young eater named Hank.
Once I get this bacon going, it's gonna fill the house with a smoky, smoky scent. Hank will feel good coming in off the bus, knowing that something's going. Also, I just like the way it makes a room smell. Everybody should have a pan of bacon going, right?
After years of feeling torn between the she-she New York City food scene and her homestead in Minnesota, Amy has blended the best of both worlds, and she's here with us now to tell us about it. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you, Gina?
Good, how are you?
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. What would you say is Midwestern about the way you cook?
It's really funny. You just played that clip. I'd forgotten that I'd said that. Of course, bacon potpourri, right?
Exactly.
That's what I grew up with, to be honest. You know, my mom cooked bacon all the time. She always had this little tiny bowl of bacon next to whatever she had going on the stove, and we would just snitch from it right before dinner, you know?
So your cookbook is called The New Midwestern Table. What's new about it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, with that book, I really aimed to kind of get it's almost like an anthology, I would say, kind of a love letter to the whole region, but really an anthology of the greatest hits. So, you know, in my travels around the Midwest, and then, you know, a lot of the book really does center more on like the northern upper Midwest, which is where I'm from, of course. So that's, you know, what really has sunk down into my bones. But I did travel. I traveled all over the Midwest. And what I did was just like collect cool stuff and see, look for repetitions. You know, I got like runzas from Nebraska. You know, I got, you know, fried chicken and different things from, you know, Kansas City. And I didn't cover barbecue because that could be its own book. Sorry.
And it is several of its own books.
It has been. It's like its own encyclopedia. But I feel like this book is an anthology and it's an updated, you know, what I did was I just took every recipe and really turned it around and looked at it from two perspectives, from, you know, the home cooking, the kind of soulful cooking that I learned from my mom and my grandma, and then also what I learned in top New York City kitchens. And so I kind of just took a recipe and decided whether it had to be made a little fancier or whether I just had to like dig deep into its roots and just go a little bit more low down and cast iron and a little, you know, grittier.
When you talk about greatest hits, what are some of the greatest hits of the Midwest?
Well, ingredient wise, you're thinking about rhubarb, you know, smoked fish, freshwater fish in general, catfish. We don't have, obviously, you know, ocean fish. And that's something that, you know, around the U.S., it doesn't get a lot of play. Freshwater fish, lake fish, things like that. And especially where I'm from in northern Minnesota, that's a huge thing. Meat, potatoes and onions. You know, really, I have an entire chapter in that book about potatoes and onions.
Yeah.
Because I feel like they're just such a huge part. Like, when you think about Asia, that's a rice culture. And I think of the Midwest being kind of a potato culture.
We are going to come back to that. But you've, as I said, you've worked in seriously top-rated New York City kitchens, really paying your dues with crazy hours, crazy expectations in that whole world. You write a lot about that in your book, Give a Girl a Knife. But
yeah, Give a Girl a Knife, that's my memoir. That's just come out in paperback this week. So that's more recent.
But I want to say
it feels like a long time ago now that I worked in top New York City kitchens. I mean, it's been a while.
You did do that. And yet, I mean, I want to say
I
that
did.
In that memoir, this cabin is really where you started your food education in a way, an informal food education. Can you talk about when you first moved in and how you started teaching yourself about food in that setting?
Yeah. So after I graduated from college in St. Paul, Minnesota, went to McAllister, and I majored in English. And so it's like, oh, I'm going to be a writer. Well, yeah, that didn't work out for another 20 years almost, right? But my husband and I, he was my boyfriend then, Aaron. He's a sculptor, and he's, you know, he's an artist. He had built this cabin out in the woods on his dad's land, and it was outside of both of our hometowns. We knew each other growing up a little bit, but in deeply in the woods, a really, really remote spot, way at the top of the Mississippi River, so like 25 minutes from a town, and really marooned. You know, like nobody would take us our post office box. We had to petition. You know, we were like ends of the earth. So there was no running water. There was no electricity, in part because it was just so far. If you can imagine, like someplace being really still in this day and age, that remote, it was.
Did you feel like a likely candidate to be living in this setting?
No, not at all. I mean, I was known as somebody my dad thought was gifted in passing off, you know, late Visa card bills. You know, I had grown up in that town, which is a rural, small place, but I have always been very taken with the city and not very woodsy, you know, very allergy ridden, not good out in the woods, not so earthy. But I kind of flipped myself a little bit in college when I became really interested in food and sustainable agriculture and those kinds of, like, you know, I was kind of like a young hippie, right? So living out in this cabin with no amenities, you know, it's kind of in the script. It's like what you do after college if you don't know what else to do. You move out to the woods and you have no bills. And, you know, for three years, half the year, we would live there. And our economy was such, though, I don't know if kids could do this today, but this was, you know, I'm 43 now, so this was like 20 years ago. And I would just work in the winters down in Minneapolis, and I had a good job in, you know, custom publishing or something. I was like a proofreader. And I would just save up all my money. And then, you know, because we had lived in this like really crappy warehouse where my husband had a studio, which is another chapter in the book, its own chapter. And then we would just move up and not really work in the summers and grow our gardens, you know. So Yeah, it was a really cool time where I was really giving myself this opportunity to study the cuisine of the pioneers. And I was reading all these old cookbooks, and I was obsessed with my grandmother's farmhouse cooking. And I was really digging into everything that would inform me later in the writing of the New Midwestern Table. And I was giving myself this kind of long leash. And I think that just that time, it was economically, I could save up, you know, $4,000 and do that. We didn't have the kinds of things, you know, just wasn't the same, you know.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the skills you did learn during that time when you were researching old recipes and looking at how your grandmother did things, but also having to figure out how to preserve food?
Yeah. Yeah. There were a lot of failures, let me tell you. It was a steep learning curve, but I really got into canning. I learned a little bit from my grandmother, but my mom was somebody who lived in town, in the small town, so she didn't do any of that stuff. Like, she thought it was great that she could afford just to shop at the store and didn't have to, you know, grow the garden that her mother had made her tend when she was a kid. So I didn't really grow up with gardening skills, but luckily, like, everybody around us gardens, you know. It's a rural community made up of, you know, kind of old timers and hippies who all have the same things in common. And gardening's big. So I learned how to can. Lots of failures, you know, the time I put caraway in the corn relish, never live it down. But I got so deeply into it that I actually, like, went to canning school at the U of M because I wanted to make jams, you know. It was one of those things. And there's an earnestness, I think, of the 90s. That play here, you know, it was a time when we didn't just, like, you know, post everything online, anything that we just were starting to do. It was this, like, we went for the authenticity all the way down, you know, and I was definitely a product of that, you know.
When you were talking about the different generations of your family and how you related to either buying things at the store or growing things, I mean, I remember from the book that you really, like, pored over historic recipes and were trying to learn from how people did things in the pioneer times. In the generation when you grew up, you clearly, that wasn't forced on you. There are other options in the world. Like, the choice of where you lived did put you in that situation. But I'm interested in just this larger trend of people wanting to learn old-timey skills that we don't have to have.
Right. But we do have to have them. See, here's the funny thing is that, I mean, it's funny because I was a child in the 80s and the 90s. And this was, like, you know, the low-fat era. And I completely skipped it because my mom was so still under the influence and of the mindset of my grandmother who grew up on the farm. And, you know, she was just looking for, like, the fattiest cut of meat in the store. She didn't like this, you know, the other white meat pork thing. Like, that didn't fly, you know? We had, so, butter was, as I write in the book, it's like, it was like lotion to combat the Minnesota winter. It was like spackle. It was ointment. It was, you know, it was like this rub for all hurts, you know? It was something that was like a salve, you know? And in an emotional way. So it was, I grew up with, like, all of this fat, and in a lot of ways, I kind of grew up still in my grandmother's era, you know. I definitely grew up with, like, new stuff, but let's say this. I grew, as a young adult, I didn't know how to make Rice Krispie bars, but I could make a mean pie, you know. So some things kind of, I had some holes in my education. But what you're asking, you keep asking me about, you know, getting back to the old ways. And for me, in the 90s, it was all about, you know, fermentation. I had also grown up with fermented pickles, which, you know, they're just like, you know, Jewish-style pickles, the salted brined pickle. That's the kind of pickle I grew up with, which is, like, very Eastern European. And so that taste I already knew, that fermentation that is so popular now, that was already lodged in my head, but it had no mirror in society. Like, nobody ate that, you know? Nobody ate real sauerkraut. Nobody ate all of these things that we eat today, and it's, like, no big deal. So for me, you know, all those things were, I was reaching back to everything my grandma talked about, which she talked constantly about food, and she was very funny, very evocative. You know, when you'd ask her, how do you grind the poppy seeds, Grandma? She wouldn't just, like, you know, give you a normal answer. She'd be like, until they're as fine as snuff, you know, something like really visual. So, yeah, I was doing all that stuff, canning, preserving. I did not go into, like, the pressure canning. It was mostly just, like, open water bath, the sweaty one, you know, the one where you sweat constantly.
Talk a little bit more about the kind of food you grew up with as part of your community in this rural Midwestern town. I remember a part about potato salad being carried to potlucks in plastic ice cream tubs.
Like
the
cream
tubs
bucket.
Of salad.
Are you familiar with this? Did this, like,
you know,
spike
it's
a memory
sort of funny.
For you
it
or
did,
not so
and
much?
It's something I kind of forgot, but I think, like, transporting ice cream tubs full of stuff to parties, like, I think in our generation that might be really frowned upon.
Right?
But that was a thing.
I know. Nowadays? I mean, can you imagine? Like, I don't know. We didn't even eat ice cream by the gallon because my mom was, I guess you'd say, a snob. I mean, I call it discerning, but she liked, like, you know, good ice cream, like Haagen-Dazs. So she would buy, though, the huge gallon ice cream jugs, I mean, gallons, so that we would have the container because the containers were so valuable. You know, I mean, this is the Midwest I grew up in. It's thrifty. And even though my own mom wasn't so much, that was the community. Like, everybody's like, oh, do you want this gallon jar with the lid? This is really a nice glass gallon jar. You know, I'm like, oh, like this, you know, oh, my gosh. Like, you know, I don't know why. It's like something about the containers. I just remember the women constantly talking about containers. And when you went to somebody's house, you know, walking in with, like, yes, a gallon ice cream bucket full of some potluck contribution, potato salad or something, you know, on your arm like a purse, basically, right? It was kind of this currency. I mean, that was just how it was done. And you cannot imagine doing that today. I don't know. It would look really weird. It's like, what did you bring me? A gallon of butter brickle? And you'd open it up. You're like, no, potato salad. You know, it just, you can't imagine it.
So back to this period in your life where you're teaching yourself these skills from another time. I remember this scene really vividly where you were devastated by a meal that you had worked really hard to prepare and it had not lived up to your mm-hmm. expectations. This is right before you decided to go to culinary school or to go and learn at another level. Your boyfriend at the time, husband now, tried to reassure you, but he did that by saying it was fine.
Yeah, which was like a dirty word. It's fine. It's fine. I didn't want it to be fine, you know?
What had you made?
Oh, I think I had made like a pork chop, like a fried pork chop. And at that time, our garden was really, you know, full to bursting. And so at the time, I was just cooking like new potatoes. I think I made German potato salad and I made something with zucchini. I was trying to be fancy. And so I made like zucchini carpaccio, which is a dish I still like to make. But, you know, something simple, but if you screw it up, it's just not good. And I think what I felt at that moment was just like the, you know, the space between what I wanted and where my skills were at. So I didn't have that, you know, I didn't have the skills and the training to get to the point where I wanted everything to taste really great, you know, I mean, that's what you want when you have these like beautiful fine materials. I'd spent all this time growing this zucchini and this is how I do it today. You know, I ordered this like really beautiful zucchini seed that's Cocozel or Castata Romanesco, which is one of those zucchinis that are Italian. They're very dense. They have ribs. They're not watery. They don't have a big seed cavity. I mean, they don't produce like, you know, the normal Midwestern zucchini, which is like overflowing and filling everybody's cars with zucchini. It, you know, it's just like a few at a time. They're very, and I'd screwed it up. I'd taken that zucchini that I'd babied from seed and I had screwed it up and it was just very disappointing. And at that moment, that is kind of when I decided, I'm like, all right, I need to step. If I really want to do this, and at that point, my interest in cooking was a full-on obsession. That's when I decided that, yeah, I'm going to go to cooking school. And I looked in the back of one of my favorite magazines, Savour Magazine, actually, which actually now I'm a contributing editor for, so that's kind of cool. But I looked in the back of that magazine, and I was like, all right, here's a cooking school. It's in New York City. Let's go.
So you go from no electricity, no running water in a cabin in the woods to New York City. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of things were different, but how was food mm-hmm. different in that environment?
Yeah, I mean, it was totally. I mean, you know, I didn't get the chance to, like, eat around the city that much because, for one thing, I didn't have the money. And secondly, I was just working constantly. I mean, I went to this kind of short cooking school. And then I didn't really learn that much either. It was okay. But I didn't pay that much either, so that was good. And then I worked, I got an internship at Boulay. Danube, one of his restaurants, he had two restaurants side by side in Lower Manhattan. And he still has one or two down there today. David Boulay. Yeah, he's one of the greatest chefs in New York City. And he's also probably the most chaotic and artistic and driven. And he's not incredibly known to be like incredibly organized, but more passionate. So he was a really good place for me to start. It was really more about the art.
And your identity within that kitchen was very much as a small woman and very much as a Midwesterner.
Short. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I felt when I arrived like as green as a fern, you know. I'd also think of this. I had spent the last 3 years, most of the last 3 years living in a cabin in the woods with there's no internet, you know. I didn't know anything. I didn't know who J-Lo was. She was in the bar. She was sitting like something about how great her butt was. I had no idea, right? I was just like completely green.
In every sense.
In every sense. I mean, food-wise, you know, it was like a brand new world because my parents were foodies, I mean, in our small town in northern Minnesota. For that, they were foodies. And when we went to the city,
what did that mean there?
Places. I mean, in there, it just meant that we ate at home, right? At home, because my mom was a great cook and it was better than what you could eat outside, which is kind of weirdly like this Midwestern thing, right? This idea that you eat better at home, right? That's kind of a rural thing. Anyway, but, you know, we did eat out in good restaurants when we went to a city. You know, that was a big thing for my family. And so I knew something of it, but not at this level I was at Boulay. There was no way. I mean, I'd never, ever had, like, a tasting menu of the likes that we were putting out.
There is a scene where someone in the kitchen says something to you about onions and potatoes that was a revelation.
Yeah. Yeah. So Danube, the restaurant, was this, it was, if you can imagine, the gilded 90s, right? And David Boulay, this restaurant was his ode to the Habsburg Empire, okay? So talk about gilt and just lush and like over the top, very extravagant. Foie gras and truffles and more truffles and all of that. And I was really taken with these parts of it. I'd never seen foie gras. I'd never, you know, handled a real fresh truffle. I'd only read about it. And so for me, those things I was spending all my time on, I'm like, oh, I got this truffle sauce on the stove and I'm like, I'm going to baby it. And in the meantime, you know, you're also supposed to be doing like 20 things, not just one thing, you know, just to stay tread above, just at water level as a line cook. That's what you're supposed to do. And the guy who was training me was this Austrian sous chef, and his name was T2, Thomas 2, because there were two Austrian sous chefs named Thomas, and we named him Terminator 1 and Terminator 2, right? This is like, that's how kitchens are. So T2, so silly. T2, though, he's like, you know, what are you doing? Like, you're doing this. What are you doing with this? Stop. You know, fiddling with your truffle sauce and the foie gras. He's like, look at this potato sauce. Like, we made this kind of like a potato stock, which is, it was kind of boring, but it was like the backbone of so many sauces. And it was important. And I was just ignoring it. It's just like totally burning away on the side. And he's like, you know, good cooking is not about truffles and foie gras and all this stuff. He's like, good cooking is about potatoes and onions. And that kind of brought it home for me. I was like, whoa, right. Because what I realized at that very moment is that so much of the kitchen and elevated fine dining and haute cuisine and all that stuff, it has its roots in the country. I mean, all that stuff is really just kind of a city expression, an urban expression of the finest rural raw materials that you can find, right? So I kind of saw that through line at that moment. I'm like, oh, yeah, like good potatoes and onions, like the ones that I had been growing in my own garden, you know, before we'd moved to New York City. And I remember thinking, like, wow, like when you dig a potato out of the ground and you don't even let it sit, you don't even let it cure, you don't let the skin harden or anything, and you just like throw it in boiling water and cook it, that's like a revelation. That's something totally different. Like the skin is sweet. It doesn't, you know how potato skin has that little bit of acidity,
yeah,
you know, that kind of a tannin to it that goes away if you put a lot of butter on it.
which is probably why people put a lot of butter on it.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't, a new potato doesn't have that, you know? So I remember at the time I was like, I'm going to sell midnight potatoes. Potatoes that are dug by midnight have never seen the light of day, and I'm going to ship them in boxes of dirt, you know, this kind of thing. But that kind of line of thinking of this perfection of something that's so simple, and it's the same thing in a rural setting as it is in a fine dining haute cuisine setting.
Well, Amy Thielen of the Food Network's Heartland Table, stay with us, okay?
You bet.
When we return, Amy will be telling us about what she discovered when she moved back to the Midwest. And you can call her if you do it quickly with an ingredient you've picked up from the farmer's market or gotten in a CSA that stumps you, or anything really that's in season now that you want a new recipe for. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Amy Thielen. She's the author of a cookbook, The New Midwestern Table. She's host of the Food Network's Heartland Table, and her memoir is Give a Girl a Knife. It's just out on paperback. Welcome back, Amy.
Hey, thank you.
So we were just talking about your revelation about what Midwestern food that you'd eaten at home had in common with haute cuisine in New York, and that is, you know, the respect for the simple ingredient that is going to form the backbone of whatever it is you're making. But when you moved back to Minnesota, what brought you back from New York for good? I mean, that had to have felt like possibly a throwing away of so much of what you had done there, because you weren't going to find Michelin-rated food in the woods.
Oh, totally. I knew that. Yeah. You know, it's kind of a funny time. It was like 2008. I had just had my son, though. You know, he was a year old. I think that pretty much changed things for me. I didn't see at the time how to be a chef and a mother of a young guy. You know, I just, and I feel bad because it's like a lot of people can do that and it's cool. And in a lot of ways, I have regrets about not doing that, not becoming, taking on. I was at that point kind of thinking, oh, maybe I'll open like a restaurant in Brooklyn. That was before like restaurants in Brooklyn were big, you know, that was like the beginning of that trend. And because at that point I had a resume, I could have been hired as a chef anywhere like that. But, you know, I don't know, something called me back. My husband and I both. There's something that we're really actually sincerely captivated by in the landscape and in about the region, even though it's so remote, it's so far away from New York City or any city, 4 hours north of Minneapolis too, 2 hours, you know, east of Fargo. I mean, it's out there, but we're into it. There's something there that feels like it's got, it holds a creative energy, some creative energy for us.
Can you describe that creative energy in a little more? Because I feel like a lot of people in this part of the country know what you're talking about, but it's not something people stop to appreciate or describe a lot.
And it's hard because in the Midwest, you're like, wow, it's not like flashy or like, this is not like Big Sur, you know, where it's like obvious where why you'd feel creative energy. But also, but where we are is also really beautiful, you know, at the top of the Mississippi. And I feel like it's kind of got this like gentle, subtle power for me. And maybe it's just because I'm from there. And so it has all these different layers of memory. But I don't know. Sometimes you just know it's like your spiritual landscape, you know, and a lot of times that is the landscape you grew up around. For me, it was. It's just got this like energy. And I feel like when I'm there, I really kind of feel this is weird. I feel like when I'm living in Park Rapids, which is the town I grew up in, and I live outside of it, but it's, you know, close enough, I feel like I kind of don't live anywhere. Like, that feels weird, right? But I feel like I kind of live in my head, which for a writer is pretty essential. And my husband's a sculptor, an artist, and so it works for him too. But I don't know, it's a little self-indulgent to admit, but I do. I feel like I kind of walk around over my past whenever I walk around in town. But I'm a little bit spaced out, and that's just kind of the way I like it.
Well, you know, you've also written some about realizing that there was a kind of ingredient. People talk about kinds of ingredients you can get in foreign lands that you can't get here. Mm-hmm. But you realize that there is a kind of ingredient you can get in the Midwest and in a rural area that you couldn't get in New York.
I mean, so many things like black currants and I mean, all the wild berries, you know, foraging the mushrooms. There's so many things that I have access to. Venison, fresh venison. You know, every year my husband and I now we'd run this like deer camp with our friends and it's a tradition. And I never thought I'd be so into it, but I am really into it. I'm like the camp cook and it's like our Thanksgiving. And, you know, I've aged the venison and take care of it and break it down and make sausage. And I mean, all those things you can't. And then just the vegetables that I grow in my garden. I mean, there's something to be said for like going down to the garden, picking the green beans and coming up to the house and boiling them and putting butter on them. I mean, that is good. That is, and it's hard to describe. It's like, that sounds good, but like, no, it's revelatory. And it's like, wow, that just made my day.
Let's talk to, speaking of ingredients, Deborah in Leawood, who has the ingredient of basil in abundance. Yay. And wants to know what to do with it. Hi, Deborah.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What have you
been doing? Hi, Deborah.
What have you been doing with basil? Like,
I have so much pesto frozen already. I've just recently started using it in lemonade. And of course, just chopping it up in pasta with some fresh tomatoes. But it is so abundant. And, what else can I do with it?
Yeah, I know. When it comes, when basil starts coming on and it really comes, it's like, woo, you're covered in it. One thing I always do with pesto is, sometimes I add a little bit of parsley to it because that makes the color, you know, set stronger and stay longer in the freezer. But you've already put away so much of that.
She's basiled out or pestoed
she's
out. Sorry.
She's pestoed out. Okay. So another thing that's really great to do is like a Thai stir fry, you know, because you can use handfuls of basil in the stir fry. So you just like stir. You have like, you know, peppers like bell peppers and some scallions or onions and chicken that you've marinated in a little bit of soy sauce and a little sugar. You know, some of the Thai food is a little bit sweet, not too. And then you want to use like a little bit of fish sauce and, you know, you kind of caramelize the meat in the wok first and then take it out and clean the wok again and then heat it up really ripping hot. Add the onions, add the peppers, get a little char on them, add the meat back in, and then add like a quart of basil. Not, I mean, almost like a lot, you know, and it'll all wilt and it forms like this kind of like floral sauce. It's so delicious.
Amy, strawberries are also in season now. And I hear that your grandmother has a jam that we should know about.
Yeah, she does. There's my grandmother used to make this jam, strawberry jam in the sun. It's called sun jam. And really, it's the best strawberry jam I've ever had. It's and so you have to try it to believe it, honestly, because you know how strawberry jam, when strawberries are, you want to make jam, there's two ways to go about it. You can do the kind of uncooked added pectin kind, right, with the liquid pectin, and you just kind of like mash the berries and it sets and you make freezer jam, and that it's really fresh tasting, but it always kind of tastes a little bit like Jell-O, you know, because it's so fresh. And then you can do a cooked strawberry jam where you cook it down till it's thick, but then it always tastes a little bit overcooked, you know, and like the strawberries have lost their freshness and kind of their life force. So the strawberry sun jam is interesting because you just bring it, the strawberries and the sugar and a little bit of lemon juice, you bring it to a quick boil just once, that's it. And then you pour that liquid, basically with some strawberry chunks, onto two different sheet trays and you cover them with a screen. And you let that evaporate in the sun for just 8 hours in a hot spot. And it's like it solidifies into a jam. It's kind of a miracle. It's kind of weird. And you can do this any day, 8 hours. That's all it really takes.
Just 8 hours.
Yeah. And it's like it gels up. So there's some sort of like weird, mysterious thing going on.
Well, oh, Amy, our time is up. But thank you so much for sharing that recipe and for sharing your story.
Yes. So nice talking to you. And good luck, Deb.
Yeah, good luck with all the basil. Amy is the author of a cookbook, The New Midwestern Table. She's host of the Food Network's Heartland Table. Her memoir, Give a Girl a Knife, just came out in paperback, and I read it. It's really good. You can listen to any of this morning's conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's where we keep all of our audio for your listening convenience. kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can share your seasonal recipes with those local ingredients with us on Twitter. We're at @kcurcst. This show is produced by Jen Chen, Suzanne Hogan, Coy Duggar, and Sylvia Maria Gross. With help from intern Trevor Hook, I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.